From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to, if you haven't already done it, I urge you to subscribe to it today. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, thank you for doing that. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, the United Methodist Church is at serious risk of becoming disunited over fundamental positions on LGBTQ issues. The denomination's special call general conference is happening February 23 through the 26th. Key questions are same-sex marriage and ordination of gay clergy. Meanwhile, the Vatican is convening the first global meeting on protection of minors in the church on February 21st, 24th. Several far-right bishops made sure to exploit the heartbreaking situation by demanding the exposure and expulsion of all gay priests, claiming that's the real root of the problem. Clearly, Pope Francis has his work cut out for him. And Eric Porterfield, a Republican delegate in the West Virginia legislature, is facing demands that he resign after giving several interviews proudly wearing his MAGA hat, in which he branded LGBTQ groups, quote, a modern-day version of the Ku Klux Klan. My goodness. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
The Spirit made a desperate effort not to confine itself to a culture, a denomination, or a doctrine, because the Spirit comes to blanket the earth with the opportunity to know God by all of God's many names and all of God's beautiful manifestations.
There are many ways to observe Black History Month. Equally as important as the visionaries and changemakers of bygone decades are those on the front lines today, especially today. Those who are amplifying the prophetic message that inclusion, celebration of diversity, and of justice is not an option for faith-inspired leadership, but is the very core of what that means in 2019 America. To witness for this kind of ministry, I'm looking forward to spending time this hour with Bishop Yvette Flunder.
You're not talking about a few comic book fans getting mad because they think this is sacrilegious. Oh no, Fox News, many and many a Christian outlet notice this. You have 100,000 people signing a signature pad that this needs to be removed. Yeah.
Many of us grew up with comic book superheroes. Maybe we saw them as role models, maybe just as entertainment, but at the end of the day, those stories helped form the worldview for generations of Americans. There have been plenty of historical and allegorical stories effectively told in comic book form. But when two leading cartoon authors created Second Coming for a leading mainstream publisher, illustrating what they think Jesus Christ would feel about the state of American Christianity today, it was too much for establishment far-right political Christianists. Long story short, the comic book series is now on hold. For the longer story, I'll talk with writer Mark Russell, who will be here. But first,
this is why marriage is such a hotbed issue. It's more than just the issue of homosexuality. They want to destroy the very image of God upon the planet. This is a demonic happening in our midst.
As if the wholesale attacks on transgender and other minority Americans at the federal government level weren't enough, there is a stunning torrent of assaults on LGBTQ rights in many state houses across the country. Keeping track of this dizzying campaign is an overwhelming task, but thankfully one that Religion Dispatches magazine and Rewire.news has taken on. For a look at some of the lowlights of this trend, I'm happy to welcome Legal Research Associate Bree Shea. Bree, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
This is quite a project. How many different states have made it into this Hall of Fame so far? And I ask that knowing that it's a constantly updated report that you are curating.
Quite a few. This year alone, probably about 9 or 10 states have different policies that could affect the LGBT community.
Mm-hmm. The anti-gay legislative attack that I think got a lot of our attention this past week is what's happening in Kansas. Would you take a few minutes and explain what is happening there?
So recently, a couple measures popped up in Kansas. The one that's getting the most attention is House Bill 2320, and that's called the Marriage and Constitution Restoration Act. It essentially prohibits the state from enforcing any type of policy that respects the rights of the LGBTQ community. And it does this by essentially, it claims that issues like same-sex marriage or gender identity, sexual orientation, all of that is directly linked to secular humanism. And because of that, it would be unconstitutional to enforce anything that might go along with that, like same-sex marriage.
Do you see building support going on for that?
It's tough to say. This isn't the first bill like this. There were three states last year that had similar language. Mm-hmm. Not as extreme as this bill, but there were other Marriage and Constitution Restoration Acts that were introduced in 2018, and that happened in Missouri, South Carolina, and Wyoming.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't get anywhere, though.
I see.
And so that was good to know. But this year, then, it's building on that. So now we have this bill in Kansas. There's also a very similar bill in North Carolina. That bill just focuses on same-sex marriage. It calls same-sex marriage a parity marriage because it's not between a man and a woman. And so that's linked to secular humanism. And so it's unconstitutional, and they want to ban same-sex marriage there. It's concerning for me that more lawmakers are taking it seriously. I don't know if it'll translate to actual votes, but the fact that these measures are popping up more in different states is concerning.
Mm-hmm. I want you to explain to me, how can a state delegitimize same-sex marriages that are recognized on the federal level? Is that even possible, or is this just symbolic pandering to the Christian's first religious right in the state?
Personally, I think it's definitely pandering. I don't think any of these have any legal avenue. The language that's in these bills is the same language that has been used in state and federal lawsuits to try and take down same-sex marriage. And I'm pretty sure all of them have been kicked out. Like they haven't advanced anywhere. Like there is no legal standing for these types of measures. It really is just, like you said, it's pandering.
Mm-hmm. The rhetoric there seems a bit confused, frankly, by clumsily labeling the basic human rights of LGBTQ persons as secular humanism and saying that that represents a religion. Aren't they actually setting up gay people for more protections? Or is that too rational a reading of their bigoted argument?
I actually didn't think about it like that. But that's a good point. I really suggest people go and actually read the text of this bill and others like it, because it kind of jumps around a bit. Sometimes it seems like it's fighting itself in what they're trying to claim, the LGBT community and how it's linked to religion, and then it's not linked or can't be. But they use the same argument in terms of abortion.
Mm-hmm.
There's similar bills happening right now in, I believe, Oklahoma and Tennessee. And those measures are trying to end the funding to, like, Planned Parenthood. And in the legislative findings of those bills, they use the same argument about secular humanism and essentially say that the idea that life doesn't begin at conception, that that's an unproven truth, and that's a faith-based assumption, and so it's linked to secular humanism, and therefore they cannot fund anything that might fund abortion. Mm-hmm.
Bree, is there enough support for this package of bills in Kansas that a significant part of this language could actually make it into law?
I want to say no. I feel like I'm being uncharacteristically optimistic, but I don't think anything's going to come of this. And even if it did, I definitely don't think it would be signed into law.
Mm-hmm. Who do you see really pushing back against this kind of hate legislation?
I think everybody. I think if it did actually be able to pass, say it passed the House, I think that'll draw even more national attention, just like the bill did last year in 2018 or even 2017, like in Mississippi and North Carolina. Those drew national attention. I think if this goes any further than it is right now, if it does make it out of committee and it does pass one of the chambers, I think there really will be a national uproar about it, just because the language in these particular bills and this one especially is just so hateful and so blatantly attacks the LGBT community that I really think, I'm optimistic about it. I think people will fight it.
Every hateful anti-gay argument can always be traced back to misapplied religious rhetoric. Would you talk about two or three other states that are particularly worrisome right now?
North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
Republican lawmakers. North Carolina is trying to ban same-sex marriage on the same basis. There are a couple, not this type of bill, but I mean, there are some measures in Texas and Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
They have maybe almost 10 measures that they're considering this year, either to ban same-sex marriage or to strip rights of transgender people, also allowing adoption agencies to refuse to place in LGBTQ families if it goes against their religious belief or conviction.
When you look at these different states, how much are they coordinated? How much of a coordinated effort is this along the lines of the Christianist Project Blitz?
I do know that just in general, the people that are sponsoring these bills or people that are writing these bills, a lot of them originate from, you know, conservative groups or anti-LGBT groups like Liberty Council, Alliance Defending Freedom. They all pretty much copy the same type of legislation and distribute it out to every single state.
Well, collating all of this information is obviously both painful and time-consuming, but you've created an invaluable and dynamic resource. And please tell our listeners how they can find the Legislative Lowlights Report, if you would, so they can go there.
So go to rewire.news, and every week I try to put out a legislative lowlights that basically highlights everything that happened last week in your state if it deals with anti-choice or anti-LGBTQ measures, religious imposition laws. We track all of them. We have a database called the Legislative Tracker. You can find it on our site. And you can search by topic, by state, by year. We go back about 5 years or 6 years now to 2013. I try to put it out every Monday. And also, or if you're on Twitter a lot, on social media, follow the hashtag Team Legal. We talk about these issues almost every day and flag these types of bills as they come in.
Bree Shea is a legal research associate for Rewire.news, where she covers state and federal anti-choice and anti-LGBTQ legislation. I don't know if she ever sleeps, but she sure does make sure the Legislative Lowlights Report is comprehensive and current at Rewire.news and Religion Dispatches. And we'll link to that from stateofbelief.com. Bree, thanks for all that you're doing, and thank you for taking time to be with us today on State of Belief.
Of course. Thanks so much for having me.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. The writer behind the comic book series that the political religious right has silenced as blasphemous, for now, I'll talk with Mark Russell, co-author of Second Coming. And up next, marking Black History Month with Bishop Yvette Flunder, I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. Just a few years ago, I think there was a certain arm's length distance from some of the most inspiring stories in our history, including those most often celebrated during Black History Month. Great things were done by great people in great moments of the past. I don't know about you, but those struggles have suddenly gotten way more current in the past couple of years, no matter how extreme the anti-Muslim, anti-Semitic, anti-gay, racist rhetoric and overt attacks have been. Things would likely be far, far worse without the prophetic voices of the resurgent religious left. With a deep personal and spiritual connection to history, she is a third-generation ordained minister. Bishop Yvette A. Flunder exemplifies the uncompromising prophetic call for inclusion and justice that is so critically important in the era we live in. And so I am grateful to have her with us today. Bishop Flunder, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much, brother. I appreciate this.
The moment we are living in is both frightening and exhilarating. Frightening because we are seeing a side of mankind that I think most of us had hoped we had evolved beyond, and exhilarating because there's a chance for moving forward in a very real way. Which of those two is coming into play in your ministry these days?
Well, I would suggest that the latter of the two realities that you just lifted up, primarily because what I am seeing happen in terms of the broad shifts and broad changes in our ministry is absolutely remarkable. For instance, I am finding that people who have been most marginalized by both religion and society, particularly women, LGBT people, people of color, are finding their way to opportunities as it relates to elected office, are finding their ways to opportunities as it relates to theological education, which, of course, does wonders to shift the sort of colonialist concepts that we have of God. And in addition to that, I think that the empowerment is not unique to the United States, but I've watched these realities also exist throughout our fellowship in different places in the world, like all parts of Asia, parts of the continent of Africa. And so there is definitively a shift and change that is occurring while all of the other realities that we're struggling against are also very prominent. But I would like to quote something that Bishop John Shelby Spong said to me one day in a coffee chat. Soup, he said, boils the most just before it's done. That is the truth. So we're watching the boiling, but simultaneously, we are watching true systemic change happening from the bottom up and from the top down.
Did you ever think we would face the kinds of challenges that we are facing as people of faith and as a society today?
Well, some of it is circular, in as much as we're seeing the resurgence of some of the realities that have existed. I am a child of chattel slavery, four generations or so back in my family. And I think that the truth is, I say often to my congregations that Pharaoh don't make bricks. Essentially, there's always an effort to try to diminish and reduce a group of people to a substandard or lower standard reality so that the people who have the strength or have the wherewithal to be in a supreme or exceptional position have that opportunity. Let me say it another way. Being high, if you're going to be high, you can only be high in relationship to someone else being low. Mm. So when I say that Pharaoh doesn't make bricks, it means it goes back to the story of the folks coming out of Egypt, that when the Pharaoh came to himself and realized that the slaves were leaving, it became imperative to find another way to get them back. And I have watched that reality happen over and over again. In order for some men to feel great, they have to diminish women. In order for some people of colonial descent, they would have to diminish what are considered immigrants or people of color. In order for America to feel great, sometimes America feels it has to diminish other countries and lands. Yeah. And that's the sad truth. And this recycles over and over and over again. What is different about this time, brother, is that I think that we are more awake and more aware than we have ever been. Theologically awake, racially awake, politically awake. We are watching this systemic reality repeat itself, but with a different set of eyes, a different hermeneutic, a different reality, a different awareness. And that's making things very different than how they have been in the past.
Bishop Flunder, you are a third-generation faith leader. How does that history inform your ministry today?
Well, the truth is, in the lineage that I am from, in their own way, at their own time and place, each of the ancestors of mine, both men and women, stood in an evolutionary place. Evolutionary for their time, evolutionary for their gender, evolutionary for their thoughts in relationship to the churches and denominations that they were connected to. I remember when my grandfather, who came out to San Francisco just before World War II from Texas, and one of the things that he did as an African-American Pentecostal man was he started to have relationships with Methodist and Baptist preachers, which was anathema mm-hmm. for Pentecostal during those times. And there were people that suggested that he was not truly saved, if you understand what I mean.
I do, and
was pushing the envelope, you know, but he did it anyway. And I have history like that in my family. And so I think I am, for my generation, in many cases, what my grandfather and some of my uncles and some of the matriarchs, my mother and my grandmother, who were both preachers, were not allowed to be called preachers, but they stood in the place where women stood and preached anyway. Mm-hmm. I think that that reality is what is under me. That's the wind beneath my wings. Mm-hmm. And I'm informed by that, brother. And I think that, you know, the real definition for prophetic call and for theological shift and for progressive thinking and process theology, all of those realities are informed often by the ancestors that had the most impact on us. So I love being the prophet for today in my family. But I have a rich heritage that came before me, and I'm very grateful for that.
How do you talk about the role that religious leaders and people of faith must play in the prophetic work of justice for all in America?
Well, one of the deep shifts that I think that we have to make, particularly as people who identify as Christian, I think we have to shift away from the ideas of exceptionalism. And this is a deep concern of mine, because the way that we read scripture suggests that there were a group of people that God favored more than any others. And that this group of people, perhaps as told in the life of Jesus, did not accept the call of Jesus. And consequently, there had to be a contingency plan. Essentially, if Jesus came to his people and they did not receive him, then the rest of the folks could be grafted in some way. One of the things that I think that is problematic about that is that somehow or other, any of us are a contingency plan. I'm a person who refuses to be the third or fourth choice. You know, I believe that I am the apple of God's eye, as I do believe that you are, too.
Yeah.
I think that theology, however, is the underpinning of this business of some group of people are exceptional by virtue of the will of God and by the realities of a misconception of manifest destiny. But in addition to that, I think when you add that to what I call an apocalyptic eschatology, which somehow also suggests that we don't have any responsibility, for instance, for the earth. We don't have any responsibility, really, to make sure that we are making our systems and our politics and our countries a better place for our children, because Jesus is coming back on Friday anyway. So what is the point, you know? Which suggests that everyone should live as large as you can, get as much as you can, because it's all going to be blown up to hell anyway in the near future. I think that apocalyptic eschatology married to an idea of exceptionalism has caused Christianity in particular to spawn thoughts and ideas that make people not conscious of our care for the earth, make people not conscious of the importance that we are all equal. We have nothing to prove to determine who is favored by God. And being favored by God is not evidenced by who owns the most, who has the most money in the bank, who lives in the most posh neighborhoods. That is not what determines if we are favored by God. And so I think that we got a lot of that from a misreading, a poor reading, a poor interpretation of the heart of God that we get often from the text. And it becomes our, you know, the underpinning of a lot of the colonialist exceptionalism that is attached to how we, and that has got to change. Mm. You are my brother. There's no ifs, ands, and buts about that. I am your sister. And there's no question about that either. No matter who our ancestors were, we are equal before God. And every human being falls into that category. And the earth is home to all of us as it stands right now. And God cares for all of us, or God is not God. That is the that's the bottom line for me.
Right. My dear friend, Bishop Gene Robinson, said something on this show a few years ago that is never far from my mind. He said, it's no longer time to tolerate or even accept sexual and racial minorities in organized religion. Anything less than celebration does a disservice to both the minority people of faith and to the rest of the congregation. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
I think it's absolutely true. And first of all, it's going to be imperative that we educate ourselves about our differences. I say it this way. I was raised by people who cook chitlins. Now, I clearly understand that most people don't understand chitlins who have not experienced chitlins. But I was raised by people who ate low on the hog because that's where we were in society. Now, I don't expect people to come into chitlins late in life, brother. You have to be raised on them, I think. But I also don't understand haggis, frankly, you know, and blood sausage and kimchi. And there's some other things that but that does not suggest that these realities, these food choices are not important to some people and not important because of their culture and experience. I think that we have got to arrive at the conclusion that part of the beauty of humanity is how varied we are. That's the beauty of it. Inbreeding, whether it is in the human family or in Christianity or religion, is dangerous to a people. It is dangerous. Mm-hmm. And so what makes people healthy is when they have several different bloodlines that come together. That's how we eradicate sickness and the kind of hereditary diseases that kill people in large swaths. I feel the same way theologically. If we would begin to celebrate the fact that we are different, which of course gives us the option to learn from one another. And even as a same gender loving woman who has been in relationship with my partner, my spouse, for 34 years, I am unique to some degree among same gender loving people. Because what people do is they make an assumption about what they don't understand and cannot and do not relate to closely. They say things like, well, you know how gay people are, or you know how women are, or you know how black people are, or you know how white people are, which is objectifying people from a distance. The challenge that we have is to get close enough to one another so we can both see and celebrate our commonalities, but we can also learn about the things that we don't really know and understand. Of course, I'm not inviting you to chitlins today, brother.
But I've been at that table.
Oh, you know about that, see? Yeah. But what I am saying to you is that there are things about my journey that I can share. You cannot relive your life and live my journey. But you can touch my journey if we have an opportunity to uniquely share with one another at a table where we have all things equal. That's going to be extremely important. This, to me, is bringing heaven to earth. Mm-hmm. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. I believe that that brings the realm of God. That kind of thinking brings the realm of God to us.
Bishop Flunder, as relentlessly as I try to understand and empathize with the needs and issues of marginalized communities, the fact is I am an older white male in America. Yeah. I'll never be able to entirely recognize the role privilege plays, no matter how hard I try. You are a member of three marginalized communities. Yes. And so I want to ask you, how do those experiences inform and inspire your ministry and your work as an activist?
Well, you know, my truth is oftentimes I reflect on beginning in so many ways the journey toward justice work in this country and across the globe. What is the thing that really informs me? And I think it is, in fact, I know now that it is very much connected to a real empathy because of the realities of being representative of so many groups that are marginalized in my body. I embody that in my body. And I also know that experience of embodying those marginalities has given me a certain amount of authenticity in the world to speak to these things. Now, it has not been a cakewalk, to say the very least. And I have experienced being wounded time and again. And most often, those scars come in the context of religion and faith.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm grateful to a large degree that I can embody them. And let me say it this way in a metaphor, that I have various places on my body, my physical body, where different things happen to me, you know, where I fell down and have a scar and I have had some incidents
yeah.
on the road and such. And every time that I have a scar, it doesn't, when it heals, it doesn't come back without some evidence that it was once there. Either a dark mark or a keloid or something that is there that reminds me. And I've learned that as it relates to scar and scar tissue, that the scar tissue, though it is not as attractive as what preceded it, it is stronger because of what it's been through.
Hmm.
I feel the same way often about myself and others who are called to really speak into this atmosphere about justice. It's not enough for me to sympathize. I have to empathize to really give myself to it. And then I say to folks who identify as you just heartily did and openly identify as someone who represents groups of people who have a certain privilege in this country and world, I would say to you that the road toward reconciliation begins with honesty and self-actualization and realizing that we can't really be reconciled without some degree of repentance.
Mm.
And there was a gentleman who said to me when I suggested this, very wealthy white man, he said, well, I don't like the word repentance. He said, I've never done anything to you folks. Those were his words, literally his words to me.
Mm-hmm.
To which I said to him, however you have benefited from what your ancestors, your folks, did to my folks. I said this to him. I said, and I'm not trying to wrap you in a cocoon of condemnation. That's not why I'm here. I'm too liberated to bind you like that, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
What I am, however, trying to say to you is that before we can just move on and gloss over and move forward, we have got to hold on a minute and accept and weep and mourn together. I think we need a process for repentance that says that although it's not what I've done, it is what the people who enabled me to be exceptional did. Let's repent for that. There's a ceremony, there's a ritual that needs to happen. And then what I believe we can do is begin from that place authentically all over the country and world to build on a future or for a future that will not either be shadowed by those who oppress or somehow hindered by those who have been oppressed. That's something that I think needs to happen. And religion is not faithful to that. It's just not. It's not faithful in the largest sense of the word. We simply want to just move on, but we can't really move on until we fully embrace where we went off track, if you understand what I mean. Or we end up repeating the same thing, as you know, over and over and over and over again. It's not about the fruit, brother. It's about the root. That's the problem.
Bishop Yvette A. Flunder is founder and senior pastor of the City of Refuge United Church of Christ in Oakland, California, and the presiding bishop of the Fellowship of Affirming Ministries. Bishop Flunder, I could talk with you all afternoon long and would love to do it, but I am already over time. So you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
You,
thank you, ma'am.
You
this conversation is part of Whosoever You Love, our semi-monthly series affirming the worth and full value of LGBTQ persons within and beyond religion. Whosoever You Love is supported by the Arcus Foundation, which is dedicated to the idea that people can live in harmony with one another and the natural world. Learn more about Arcus and its partners at arcusfoundation.org and find the entire series at www.whosoeveryou.love. Time for one more break, and then a comic book writer whose work has been denounced as blasphemous by the political religious right and Fox News. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. I imagine that when Mark Russell and Richard Pace collaborated on the comic book series Second Coming for a mainstream publisher, they expected to ruffle a few feathers. Sometimes a little controversy is even good for business. But this is 2019 America, and the forces have realigned in ways that keep surprising even the most jaded of us. We may not have blasphemy laws in this country yet, but that doesn't mean pressure groups can't silence messages they don't like. Even, ironically, prescient ones like Second Coming. For a look at all of this, I'm happy to welcome Mark Russell to State of Belief Radio. Mark, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Would you expand a bit on what happened to Second Coming?
Yeah, I mean, we had been announced to publish with Vertigo DC Comics back in July. And I'd written six issues, and Richard was knee deep in the drawing, and they seemed very happy with it. But then they came back and said, "Well, you know, there's a few minor tweaks we want you to do." So I made those, and the editorial staff and I felt very happy about where we'd gotten the story. But then they said there were going to be more major changes coming down the pike from up top, and also that they were going to release it at a later date. And the two things that I wanted above all for this publication were that for the story to be as good as it could possibly be and for it to get into the hands of the fans in a timely fashion. And I felt that that meant that the latest announcement of the changes and the delay meant that neither of those was going to happen. So I had a frank conversation with them. And I said, well, and we all just kind of agreed that if those were my goals, then perhaps the best thing would be to ask for the rights back and take it somewhere else, which was totally fine with me. It'll still get published somewhere. It's just a question of who's going to publish it. So, I had a really good working relationship with them, and they really did a lot to get it, the story, into the shape it is now, where it's ready to be seen by people, and they poured a lot of love and work in it. So I have nothing but, you know, good memories and admiration for the staff at DC and what the work they've done on this comic. But, you know, sometimes it just doesn't work out with the publisher and you have to go somewhere else.
Mark, were you surprised at this backlash, and how effective was it?
I was surprised at the timing, because it was announced in July, and we didn't get this backlash until January. And I think it was because Fox News ran a selectively edited interview I'd done with another media organization. I think to run sort of a culture war story during the government shutdown, when things were not going particularly well for President Trump, they tend to sort of lean on the culture stories more. So I happened to be one of the stories they chose to run with. And that's when the backlash started. That's when the furor really went. I think it happened because of two reasons. One, because it had big name conservative media behind it this time, and also because it was the outrage was based on articles that were selectively edited interviews, which did not give a complete picture of what the comic was going to be about. So they made it sound like the whole comic was going to be about Jesus Christ as a sort of bungling sidekick to a superhero, which is not really what it's about at all. It's about Jesus and the superhero having two very different approaches to the problems of the world and using power in completely different ways. And ultimately, Jesus is the one that comes off as the hero because his use of empathy and forgiveness to solve problems and to heal the world turns out to be much better than, you know, the ability to punch holes through walls.
Yeah.
Or, you know, drop kick somebody into the next county.
Do you think the publisher was taken unawares? And let me tell you why I'm asking that question. I've become convinced that vast swaths of our secular society really don't understand how well-organized and intensely committed far-right theocratic Christians First forces have become in our country. You think the publisher was unaware?
Yeah, I don't think they expected something like this, for sure. And I think that social media, modern technology has allowed people on left and right to galvanize outrage in a way that's never been really organized before. So Citizen Go is this conservative petition maker that works out of Spain, actually. They're in Europe. They're not even American. But they are able to marshal these petitions that send hundreds of thousands of signatures to American publishers, companies, governments, to basically pressure them into giving in on whatever cause they're endorsing at the moment. And so, yeah, it's and each one of those signatures on the petition generates an angry email. So it can be quite disconcerting, I imagine, to get 230,000 angry emails in your inbox all of a sudden. And it looks like, you know, the villagers are at your doorstep with pitchforks and torches. But really, it's 230,000 people globally. So it's one person in Poland. It's one person in Romania. It's, you know, a few people in France. It's, you know, maybe a handful of people over here. So 230,000 people from a global sort of coordinated petition gathering effort is really not that many. It's not that there's 230,000 people in your backyard screaming, demanding that you give in to them. It's that they've managed to find 230,000 people with 3 seconds to spare to click on a yes, I'll sign this petition button online. And so they've done a great job of amplifying the outrage to make it seem bigger than there is. But I think that's what it is, really. It's kind of smoke and mirrors enabled by social media.
Yeah. Mark, I understand you don't personally identify as a Christian. Do you now identify as a blasphemer thanks to these events?
No, I don't. I have a lot of I feel like I am a great admirer of Christ. But I admire him because of the things he said and did, not because I imagine him some sort of gateway to eternal life or some sort of possessor of magic tricks that I would like to benefit from. I think he was genuinely a brilliant philosopher, and he's one of the few people to ever come up with an alternative to bribery and violence as a way to get people to do the right thing. And I think he deserves a huge amount of credit, and I think Christ is wonderful, and I encourage people to be Christians, but I encourage them to think of Christianity not as something you are, but as something you do. So when I think the world would be great if more people were Christian in the sense that they were actually emulating the words and deeds of Christ, as opposed to, you know, being themselves and emulating the Romans who crucified Christ, but can think they're forgiven just because they happen to have Christ as the mascot of their team.
You know, I think it's just breathtaking that a key part of the Second Coming narrative is how disappointed Jesus is to find what's been happening in his name. I mean, this is a deeply scriptural story. And of course, the condemnation of your story by so-called Christians is nothing short of total irony as they display the exact behavior you expose.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I it's really them that is being parodied. It's not Christ at all. It's how the followers who took Christ's message of being able to, like, overcome oppression and overcome, you know, violence and greed, and they've used it as a tool of violence and greed. Mm-hmm. And that's what appalls Christ when he comes, when he returns to earth in my story, mm-hmm. to find that his story has been co-opted to serve the exact opposite of what he wanted. And yeah, it's ironic to see people actually acting out the very criticism that I'm making. Of course, they'll probably never read the comic and get the irony. But yeah, it's there.
Yeah. So what are your plans for Second Coming going forward?
Well, we've written 6 issues, and our goal is to get another publisher to pick it up so that those 6 issues can get produced and out into the world. And then hopefully do 6 more after that.
Mark, what has all of this taught you about the state of the nation we live in and the role of organized religion is playing in legitimizing those in power instead of serving the most in need?
Well, I think that people have allowed institutions to use Christ as a tool of oppression against them, when Christ always wanted to be a tool that they would use to against the oppression of institutions. And I think that this is really what I would like for people to think about, is like how institutions should exist to serve them. They should not exist to serve institutions. And I think that's the core of Christ's message when he said that the Sabbath exists to serve man. Man does not exist to serve the Sabbath. Mm-hmm. That's what he's talking about. He's like, religion, power, all of it is only worth anything if it actually serves the people under it. If the people under it have to ignore their own interests to serve the power, then what they're voting for is not Christ, it's the Romans.
Yeah. Mark Russell is the writer of Second Coming, a comic book series that provoked the fury of the theocratic right at shrieks of blasphemy by accurately, if provocatively, portraying what today's Christianity would look like to Christ himself. Mark is the author of numerous books, including God is Disappointed in You, and has been nominated for a 2019 GLAAD Media Award for Exit Stage Left, The Snagglepuss Chronicles, published by DC Comics. Mark, this is a painful but priceless snapshot of the culture that we're living in right now. I'm really grateful to be able to talk with you today on State of Belief Radio, and keep up the good work.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your generous support for this program helps keep us on the air week after week. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, let me say thank you. I say thank you on behalf of all of us at State of Belief, but I also say it on behalf of every one of our listeners. If you think there's value in what you've heard here, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date for subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and be part of the conversation. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.